Tablets are great devices, especially if you choose the one that's right for you. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Visiting today with Jesse LeGru. He's back once again, technical team lead with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. He focuses on desktop and laptop security projects. And we'll be talking about selecting tablets. He'll also answer your other computer questions as well. So I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And send us an email at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And Jesse, great to have you back.
Good to be here.
Well, let's start with some real basics on tablets. What is a tablet and how does it differ from maybe your PC or your laptop?
So in a tablet is normally, if you at least for people who use smartphones, you can kind of think of it as a larger, more fully featured smartphone. It gives you a lot of the capabilities that you might have on a normal laptop or even on a smartphone. But in general, they're lower cost. The screens are, you know, anywhere from a few inches to even bigger. They can actually get pretty large, but they're really designed to just give you most of the functionality that you'd want to do on a day-to-day basis, reading, writing documents. Some people just use them to check the web.
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as features, they can run a very, very wide feature set. You can get a tablet that's basically a fully functioning computer, which, you know, not basically, it is a fully functioning computer. You can install Photoshop on it, for example. So you can do everything that you might be able to do on your normal desktop or laptop, but it's really meant to be a smaller device, cheaper, cost effective to do maybe 80% of your day-to-day internet usage or productivity tasks.
Yeah. So there's different divisions or different types, major divisions, I guess you could say, when it comes to tablets.
Yeah, normally when I look at breaking it down, I break it down based on kind of the type of operating system or the manufacturer of the device. So usually when I think of tablets, similar to smartphones or even desktops or laptops, I think of iOS devices. So, you know, Apple tablets, otherwise known as iPads. Windows-based tablets, which are the Surface or Surface Pros made by Microsoft, and there's a lot of other manufacturers out there, then also Android tablets. Those are the main three that kind of rise to the surface, and they have different functionality. They work a little bit differently, but especially due to the rise of the iPhone and how people interact with that device on a day-to-day basis, most of these devices are intuitive because they're really taking off the lessons learned of how that device worked and how people interact with it. So those are usually the three main types. And then from there, you can go a wide range of cost and functionality, size, what size screen, and is it very high definition, for example, you're going to watch movies on it. So it goes, you know, a little crazy from there.
I've got to admit that I find myself not using my iPad as much as I did because I'm using my phone a lot more, and it's kind of become my tablet in a way.
Yep, and I kind of had the same thing. So I have an iPhone I've used, but also an Android phone. I can do everything I really want to on both of those devices. You're usually finding the point where, well, the screen's too small. That's kind of,
yeah.
When you get to that point, then you just need a bigger device, which where a tablet or even a computer comes in, where it's just, it's not as effective to do your day-to-day. But I can do a lot of what I need to do on a day-to-day basis from those two mobile devices. And if I go up to a tablet, it's effectively the same device.
Yeah.
It's just bigger. You may have a little bit more power behind it as far as processing power. You may have more storage, but most of them work very much the same if they're not almost exactly the same as far as the operating system and the software that you can have loaded on it. So it's really the difference of size versus the difference of functionality.
Someone wondered, you mentioned software, and somebody was wondering about, well, what's the difference between apps and software?
And at least from how I look at it, I consider them the same thing. Apps obviously are software. There's a developer somewhere or a group of developers that develop software for us to use. They simply make it available on something like an app store where we can download it. But it's software just like anything you might have in your normal computer, whether it's Microsoft Office, whether it's Pages, or even Audible if you're listening to books. So it's still software developed by a group of developers and put out into a central store. So there's not much of a difference. You can get a little bit into what's free, what's not, what's open source. And, for example, if I want to install Firefox on my computer, I go to a website and I download and install Firefox. Can you do it the same way on a tablet? Maybe. But many times you have to go through a central app store, whether it's the Play Store for Android or whether it's the App Store for Apple. Windows is a little bit different. So it's just a different way to look at the similar thing.
And when you're thinking about pluses and minuses for, let's say, the Apple versus an Android, where do you see the pluses and minuses?
For me, it's usually working with my other devices. So I use an Android phone for all of my home day-to-day stuff. And I know how it works. I know what applications are available. If I were to get a tablet, I might get an Android-based device just because I know it. Same thing with iOS. And, when people look to find out, I want a tablet, what do I get? Well, you're going to have a ton of choices and it's going to be really difficult to make a decision. Look at what you know. If it works for you, it's really the bigger version with a little bit more power behind it. If you find there are limitations that you're seeing, then it might be good to look at a different device. But there's, a large amount of difference in what you can do and how you can do it. One thing that I've come back to in the past many times is the Surface Pros from Microsoft, because those I can actually install software just like a normal computer. It just happens to be smaller. Granted, the price is much, much higher.
What's the range there?
The range, it might start around $400 to $500, and it can get up over $2,000. Because you can, just like I said before, you can install Photoshop and do video production on a tablet, but you are going to pay for that hardware cost and everything else. But when I look for a tablet, I'm thinking cost effective, but some people want this tablet to be a full computer replacement. Generally, that's not what you think of when you think of a tablet, but that is something that people do want.
And what's the life of those? I mean, realistically.
Well, it's interesting. It always depends on what you're using your tablet for. And I've used iPads to browse the web, check email, look at my calendar, very basic things. I have one of the original iPads. It's, I don't know how old it is, at least 5 to 10 years old. It still works fine.
Yeah.
You don't get software updates and a lot of other items. That's where, depending on the system you have, if you do want to get software updates or load the latest software, you might run into those situations where, you're going to need to buy another device. But it really does depend on your need. For me, I could probably use one for at least 5 years. I've noticed over time, a computer I thought that would last me 2 years now lasts me 5 years. And I just think as time goes on, they're going to extend that life more and more, even if the warranties really don't match up with it. So you could use it for quite some time.
Yeah, I've got an old one. I've got a couple of iPads, one old, about 10 years old at least, and another one's about 4 or 5 years old. And I still use the old one. You can still use, although I've got to admit, my iPhone is typically what I'm using most of the time.
Well, and when I do use my iPhone or the iPad, I notice the iPhone's snappier.
Yeah.
I'm seeing the increased performance, and all of a sudden, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, maybe I do want a newer iPad because you get a good feeling from everything responding exactly the way you want. When you go back to this older iPad, you're just waiting and waiting. So, part of it's your convenience, part of it's what you're doing on a day-to-day basis, but also over time, people's needs change. I did a lot of heavy technical stuff, but now it's like, no, I want to see my calendar, my email. That's really what I want to look at if I can open up Google Docs and take a look at this. So my needs have changed, and that actually means when I might buy a new tablet or what tablet I might buy is going to change. So need definitely does drive what you're looking for, how it works, and if the tablet you bought today works in 6 months for you.
Yeah. Well, we have callers online. Ray in Rhinelander has a question, so let's go there. Ray, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you, Larry. And once again, you always have somebody on that I need to talk to, especially today. I would like to know your guest's opinion on the Samsung Galaxy Tab E, the pluses, the minuses, just a general on it. The reason I like this is I don't have a computer in my house. I have a flip phone that I get service almost anywhere. That's why I keep it. I'm out in the field a lot. I'm out in the woods. I do research on all kinds of things. I do a lot of social things. And the Galaxy Tab E is very convenient to bring along with me. It has just a full range of solutions and applications I can use. And I'm quite happy with it. There's still a lot for me to learn on it, but I'm amazed at all the functions this thing has, and it's just unlimited. So I would like your guest to give me an opinion if he knows about this tab or what he knows. And I'll take the comment off the air. And
all
thanks,
right.
For it.
Yeah, thanks, Ray.
So, and I haven't used a lot of the tab, a lot of the Galaxy tablets. I've used a couple in the past, some of the Notes. And what I find surprising is just like the I have a Samsung Edge phone. It's very similar to a lot of the tablet devices. And the functionality that comes in just by being an Android device, you get the capabilities of all the different apps that are at the store and what you can use. And personally, I just really like the Android tablets because not only do they work and they have a lot of functionality, whether it's apps, having Bluetooth, I do that for headphones a lot. It works really, really well. It's very full-featured, and it doesn't have to cost $1,000.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a big one for me, especially with technology changing and needs changing. I don't want to have to buy a different device every year. Even every 2 or 3 years, I really don't want to. And as long as people are developing apps and I can download it and install it, it works great. So I really do like a lot of the Galaxy tablets. But, you know, I notice from time to time something might look a little bit differently, but generally it's Android. You're going to get the same apps. It really depends on the hardware and the battery life. So how long does the battery last? If it lasts, a full day and it has good power saving, that's, you know, what I need in my life. But you can also use it pretty heavily and make sure that the battery doesn't quite last a full day. But I really do like the Galaxy tablets. They work very well.
Frank and McQuantigo, we turn to you next. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I currently have a Samsung 2014 tablet, 10-inch, and a soon-to-be 8-year-old Windows laptop. And I'm thinking about replacing them both with a newer laptop that has a touchscreen that's bendable over and can be used as a tablet. And I kind of want to get your thoughts on that, if you see any big gotchas in that approach.
And I think most of the time, it always depends on how you're going to be moving it around on a day-to-day basis. So different laptops that I've used, so I'll just kind of chat about that a little bit. One thing I'll bring up is, even what I brought up before, is the Surface Pro. It's a tablet. It doesn't have a built-in keyboard. You can easily connect one and use it like a fully featured PC. So you get just about the smallest footprint that you're going to get for a laptop. It definitely would replace anything that you, even if it's several years old, and it would work really well. One thing I always look for that's difficult for me is keyboards. Is the keyboard comfortable for me? That's going to be different from each person. If it doesn't come with a keyboard, you kind of have a little bit more flexibility in what to buy. But that's where going to a store and actually being able to touch, pick it up, test the keyboard would be really important. Most of the touchscreens are going to be similar. You might have differences in definition. But actually, the keyboard, probably for me, is the biggest thing, especially if it does come with a built-in keyboard, because generally they're going to be smaller. And I've used different kind of flip devices. The ones I like the most are the tablet convertible devices where I can easily kind of flip it around 180, and it just it basically feels like a thick tablet. I don't have the cumbersome nature of the keyboard, but there's also just a lot of touchscreen laptops that aren't intended to be tablets at all. They're just laptops that happen to be touchscreen. So there's a lot of differences out there in how you can use it. But the biggest thing for me is knowing what the keyboard's like and knowing what the options are. And for any tablet, I also want to make sure that I have wireless connectivity, whether it's just the internet, but also Bluetooth. Bluetooth and a lot of those other technologies are going to be important when you're plugging in other devices. How many USB ports are there? Those are the features that you might see, you know, moving in and out, where it might not be as available. I did have a Dell Venue that's smaller. It doesn't really have USB ports, so I can't plug in devices or charge them the same way. So USB ports, keyboard, wireless connectivity, and then just generally the touch and feel. So I highly recommend going to a store, probably a few stores, because you're probably not going to see all the options at one place. It'd be really difficult. And actually, you know, touch and pick up some of these devices to see if it really does work for you. I do really like the Surface Pros, but they are expensive. But you can find a lot of great tablets out there that are going to work very, very well.
All right, Frank, thanks again for calling. Jim in Winnebago County, we'll get to you in just a second. Just a reminder, as you're listening in, Jesse LeGrew is our guest today, technical team lead with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn talks with a reporter about what happened to his third-grade classmates at Milwaukee's Samuel Clemens Elementary School. He went back and found out what they were all up to, and we'll hear about that at 2 o'clock. Right now, taking a look at your computer with Jesse LeGrew of the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Jim in Winnebago County, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry and Jesse. I have two questions. One is about comparing two desktop computers that I am considering buying for a shop, a place that is not used heavily, but one that I want to have access to the internet. The shop has wireless internet. And so my question about the computers is, the one has a sixth-generation i3 processor with rated at a speed of 3.2 gigahertz. The other one, which is considerably less expensive, has an i3 processor at 3.1. The latter one, by the way, is refurbished. The difference between the storage and the newer one, the more expensive one, is 500 gigabytes versus 160. And the thing that I'm most concerned about is the more expensive one has LAN and I think WLAN, which does that mean wireless network, versus the less expensive one has only LAN. So can you advise me on that?
So for I'll take a look at least the processing power. Are you looking at, it sounded like when you were going to be using it, it's going to be for very general use, maybe web browsing and a lot of other light application use. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct.
So I think either one is going to work very well for you in that case. I also think that the space, one is about 500, one is, you know, a little bit over 100 gigabytes of space. I think either of those are actually going to work very well for you in this case as well, unless you're going to be storing a lot of music or other files. So I think that's okay. The two features that I'd probably compare most is going to be the amount of memory or RAM, random access memory, and also... you did note that you're using wireless, and that WLAN is wireless local area network. So it's able to use a wireless signal and give you the internet.
The other one isn't.
Right. So the LAN is one you have to plug in. WLAN is one that you're able to use the wireless. So it sounds like the one that is the refurbished, that is the less expensive, it sounds like it may not have wireless.
But I could probably use an adapter onto a USB port?
That you most likely can. I'm guessing these are Windows-based laptops?
Yeah, Windows 10.
For those, I've used a lot of, you know, what they call dongles, wireless dongles, so you can just plug it in with your USB, install some drivers, and you're all set. They're actually very inexpensive. You can get one for $10, plus or minus, and all of a sudden you have wireless internet. So as long as you have, you know, wireless internet available for you to connect. But I think, you know, if you get one of those, I would actually, you know, depending on the price difference, I'd probably go with the refurbish if you just want something to work and it actually is a significantly lower cost because it's going to do what you need to do. And I always think about it, you know, if I, let's say I'm spending $200 on one and $1,000 on the other, if I have the cheaper one and it breaks, I can still potentially buy four more of them and have, you know, the same amount of, at least monetary investment, maybe not time investment. So normally I'd go with the refurbished, potentially even buy the wireless adapter for it, but it really does depend on the cost difference. If sometimes wireless dongles can have the, they kind of get in the way. So if you ever feel like you might snap it off because of how people are moving in the space, that could be another concern. But overall, I think for your use, either one should work as long as you get the wireless internet or the wireless Wi-Fi dongle for the refurbished laptop.
Well, that's great. Now, the question I had about a printer, this may seem silly, but we, unlike Larry, are snowbirds, and we spend 4 months in southern Arizona, which means that for 8 months our inkjet printer sits idle. Last year when we came back, we had a heck of a time getting that thing to work again. Is there anything that we can do to prevent that problem next time we head back to Arizona? Such as, is there a way to actually print from Wisconsin on that printer in Arizona a couple times a month?
So there actually is, and this might go very, very deep into the weeds a little bit. So it depends on your printer. Some of them, they have different wireless printing features that you can use. But one thing that is usually a challenge for the printers, especially for inkjet, is they have, you know, physical ink that they're printing out. It's wet, it dries up, and due to that, you know, ink just doesn't come to the page. So you have the ink heads and you actually have the ink cartridge. And once again, this is a little bit different per printer and how they have it all done. But if I were to leave a printer for 8 months, I might actually consider taking the print cartridges out, covering the print head just to make sure that it's not open to the air, and even cleaning out the ink heads just to make sure they're clean. That way there's not going to be anything that's going to dry up, and then when you come back in 8 months, you just take off the tape, plug it in, print, and you're all set. But it does depend on your printer. It depends on the cartridges and a few other things. But finding a way to print once a month is another option.
Yeah. There you go. Good luck, Jim. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Pat in Oshkosh next. Hi, Pat.
Hey, good afternoon. I've got a CD collection that's now my desktop is the way I used to, you know, be able to burn a CD and drop it onto one of the first edition iPods. But now I've got the iPhone. Is there a way to get the CD collection, you know, transferred onto there without going through the desktop?
And in this case, so do you already have the music stored digitally, or do you just have the, you know, physical CDs?
No, let's just say physical CD.
Okay. There is, to get it from the CD onto your iPhone, outside of simply purchasing them from the App Store or a different location, if you want to convert the ones you already have, you're going to need to have something with a CD-ROM drive that you can actually do the import and conversion, and either upload to iCloud or directly synchronize with your iPhone. So you're going to need some device to do that conversion. There are some services probably out there that might do it for you, but you're really going to need a desktop or a laptop, something to convert the CDs, unfortunately.
Oh.
I figured that. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Mike in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Wanted to find out if your guest knows anything about Neverware. It's software that's free or very inexpensive to convert older Windows PCs or Macs into Chromebooks. he's had any experience with that. And
I have actually never used it.
So
I don't have I don't have anything to know. Do you have anything that you can share with me?
I know there's a website, Neverware. It's spelled like never with W-A-R-E, like software.
Yeah.
Neverware.com. And it's something, I think it came out last year. I've just read some recently read some articles on it. But, yeah, the idea is that you can take an older computer that may be running kind of slow, but you can convert it to a Chromebook. So it's all cloud-based, and so it kind of breathes new life. That's what they're claiming, is it breathes new life into the older computers. There's a free home version that they have, a version that for $15 a year includes the Office 365 software.
Oh.
Wow. So I thought, wow, that sounds like a heck of a deal, because I've got some old laptops laying around gathering dust, and I thought, wow. But, you know, that's one thing that, for the claims, it's like, you know, how does it work in the real world? I was wondering if you'd had any experience with that, but
no,
maybe some
and
of your listeners have.
Yeah, and I definitely have, and it's one of those items that at least I thought about quite some time when I've had old machines, is, hey, Linux is free. Let me install Linux, and I'll test, and granted, this is because I want to invest a lot of time, but try, you know, six different flavors of Linux to see which one is going to work the best for me. And this sounds like a great idea. I just don't have any direct experience, but, you know, it looks like they want you to have 2 gigabytes of RAM, which is actually pretty low. So, you know, a computer within the last 5 to 10 years should work pretty well. But it sounds like a great idea. Just haven't had the
Maybe
experience.
Somebody else has. Stay listening, Mike.
I will.
Yeah, because likely somebody else has, and they'll call in and let us know. So keep listening. Ron in La Crosse has a different question. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I have a question. I had my LaserJet Samsung printer working pretty well with my laptop. It's Windows 10, and I was able to work. I use a USB cord, and I'm using it offline. And last time I tried to do it, it looks like it's going to print. It's showing the Samsung printer webpage, and I click on print, and I wait, and I wait, and it says it's going to print, and then it shows air printing in a little pop-up window in the lower right corner. And here's the thing, you know, it was working with this Lenovo ThinkPad Windows 10 laptop before. I got so frustrated. I also have a Mac Mini, so I paired that wirelessly with my LaserJet printer. And what I printed, when I went to print, it turned out what I wanted. The printer turned it out first time. So, you know, I wasted all this time. And I don't understand why the laptop connected with a USB cord to this LaserJet printer worked so many times, and now it wouldn't.
And for this kind of problem, and obviously in this case the wireless works, for the Samsung machine, I'd actually consider trying the wireless just to see what happens. But normally, and this is kind of a very, very old method, but what I've done in the past is simply, you know, unplug, reseat the cables, turn off the printer, turn off the computer.
I've done that.
Okay. And when you hit print, it sounds like the printer itself was doing something. But is that the case? Do you hear the printer trying to work and like it's...
Yes, I do, once in a while. But the page never came out. Paper never came out at all. And it showed that in the lower right corner of my laptop screen. Printer error consistently. Mm-hmm. It really makes a person cynical, because it looks like it's going to do it. You know, it's going to print with that USB cord. And then it shows printer error.
One, does it say anything additional outside of just the generic error message?
Well, it's probably a code number or something. I don't remember what it was.
Yeah.
One other thing I try, assuming, sometimes you know, there can be automatic driver updates or other updates that come that don't necessarily, an update's not necessarily a good thing sometimes. One thing I would try to do is actually to go into your control panel on your Windows computer and actually completely delete the printer. I would unplug the USB cord first, but delete the printer, make the computer feel, you know, you have no printers at all you can use. Once that's done, plug the printer back in. It will try to automatically redetect and reinstall the printer with the appropriate drivers. Maybe that in itself will allow it to work if it, you know, decides, well, I'm going to pick this driver, I'm going to set it up from scratch, just to see how that works. That may or may not resolve the issue.
Okay, it did come with an install disk. Should I use it?
I would say probably not. I would try first without. If anything, when you get to a point, if it does need software, it'll ask you if you have a disk available. At that point, you can use the disk, but many times it'll actually try to reach out to the internet, and it'll try to get the software that it feels it needs for the printer. But yeah, I would try to allow it to reinstall, set it as a default printer, and try to print a test page. And that's actually one other thing I'd try even before deleting it, is when you right-click on the printer in Control Panel, when you look at Devices and Printers, you can go to Properties, and actually it has a little Print Test Page button. It's a little more simplified than printing a full page of a picture or a document from another program, and see where that comes up. But I would actually delete the printer, reconnect it, let it reinstall, and then try to print it again and see how that goes.
Well, there you go. Good luck. Thanks so much for calling. Linda emailed to say that increasingly apps on her iPad 2, which she got in 2012, give her messages that they no longer run on the iOS she has. Unfortunately, iPad 2 is not really upgradable to the newest iOS versions. Is her iPad 2 eventually going to be obsolete? Is this part of Apple's strategy to get you to have to continually buy new iPads, or do newer iPad versions accommodate continuous iOS upgrades?
And this is actually similar to even some of the Mac hardware that we've been seeing, well, forever, but definitely within the last 5 or 10 years since OS X. If you want the latest software updates, you need the latest hardware, or at least hardware within a certain age range. So in this case, you really do have to get a newer device in order to support it. Part of it's because the software isn't really meant to support, or it's not going to really work well, if at all, on some of this older hardware. So it does necessitate upgrading just because the software is not going to work the best. If you do develop new software and you want it to be the best experience for the customer, there is an incentive to not allow it to be installed on older hardware, because that user experience is actually going to be poor. But also because the hardware is at an age where it's really been replaced by newer technology. So yeah, unfortunately it's at that time where, yep, you need to basically buy new hardware if you want the latest upgrades. And Apple also does something similar for their operating systems on any of the Mac hardware, so laptops or desktops. They generally support the latest 3 versions of the operating system, so you're able to get updates and support. But if you're anything older than that, you're kind of on your own. And if you need to upgrade, sometimes it does mean you have to buy new hardware.
Lyle in Amory, let's turn to you now. Hi, Lyle. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have had a laptop computer.
Okay.
And it died, and I have had a family tree maker, Ancestry family tree maker on it. I backed that up onto a flash drive, and now I have a Chromebook. Is there some way that I can hook up to that flash drive and get that Ancestry? It won't take the Chromebook won't take the Ancestry disk. The Chromebook don't have a disk port.
In this case, and I've helped some people who've had actually this application in the past, but I do not believe it's going to work on a Chromebook. The one service that they do have, because I know you can install the program and work on it, but I believe they also do have a cloud version, which might work on a Chromebook, but you'd have to use a different computer to import all of that data into that cloud service. So unfortunately, you're going to need a different kind of device with, I believe they have a macOS version, but I'm not sure. You're probably going to have to find a Windows computer, actually, to either import the data into that cloud service or use that long-term. There's nothing on the Chromebook that would allow you to natively use that application.
Hmm.
Could I install some kind of a family tree maker that is supported on Chromebook? They have some on their application page, but I don't know how to. Can I import them from the Ancestry one?
You may be able to, but at least from my experience, I don't know if it's on the different Chromebook Play Store and they have an Ancestry, the Family Tree Maker application you can download. It's possible. I just don't know if there's any other features or data they need to be stored somewhere else. It's possible. Part of me does doubt it, just because when looking at Family Tree Maker and what's required on a normal PC is not available on the Chromebook.
Yeah.
So my gut reaction is that it wouldn't be available, and you still need that PC to upload it. But I haven't tried.
Well, there we go. Thanks, Lyle, for calling. Appreciate your call. Susan emailed to say she wants to purchase a Chromebook for a 7-year-old child. Reviews are all over the map, from terrible to wonderful for all brands. Anything you'd recommend?
Well, I think as far as a tablet or what to use, I think anything could work. But it all depends on how, in this case, the child is used to working with technology. Some will use it right off the bat with little to no instruction, or have already been using it in school or in other scenarios that allows them to work on it better. For me, when I think of any younger child using it, I always consider what happens if it gets thrown or broken. So hardware warranties are actually probably more of a concern for me. But I think that any tablet really could work. It just depends on how, you know, you might envision the child using it. Because there's a lot of things you can do with a tablet. Some you may not want them to do on a tablet. So having more flexibility might be a good thing, but having more flexibility might also be a concern.
Yeah.
I think children are getting very used to using a lot of different devices, whether they're Android or iOS. I think it just depends on how much control you want over the device. Like Chromebooks, for example, allow you to actually control quite a bit. And you still get a lot of the different features that they're going to find useful. But if they're used to a Windows PC or a Mac OS PC, it's limited as far as what it can do. It doesn't have to be a bad thing. It's just different.
And Chromebooks, you know, the school, your child's school may be using Chromebooks, and so...
Yep,
that'd be my guess anyway.
Yeah, it's actually very popular to have schools with those that they can give one per student and even take home, like it's theirs. So it's very likely that they're using something similar in the schools because it is cost effective and it works for, you know, 95% of needs out there.
Jesse LeGrew, technical team lead with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your personal computer today with Jesse LeGrew from the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for listening in. Call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Mary in Eau Claire up next. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have a question with regards to my photo files. I have an iPad mini and a Mac, also a Chromebook, and about 3 cameras. And the photos I take on the iPad mini, they're pretty nice, but they'll only open in the Mac on the Photos app. And, you know, I want to take photos from all the cameras and have them inside the pictures folder so I can open them with either Photoshop or another app. And then I have old stuff that only opens in the iPhotos app that I have to move around and then look for duplicates and hunt away. So I'm looking for a way to unify iPad photos and without using that wretched Photos app. It just drives me nuts.
And so this is something that I don't do a whole lot of photo editing, but I take pictures, and I like to make sure that I can see those pictures on multiple devices, including an Android phone, an iPhone, Windows PC, a Mac. So There's a few options out there. One that I actually have used in the past is some cloud-based storage services. They might not be putting stuff directly into that Photos folder, but it will at least unify the storage so that you can see them on every single device. So in the past, I've used Dropbox. Dropbox is a service that you can actually store a certain amount for free. And then it's only at that point where you hit a limit where you might have to, they have a subscription service you can pay for. And it's same, there's a lot of other storage services out there. Box, OneDrive with Office 365, Dropbox, which I mentioned before. And there's probably even more than that. My recommendation would actually be to use one of those different services. I do know that all three of those do work on, they would work on an iPad, and they also would work on a Mac OS desktop or laptop.
Okay, I was just hoping to have them on the pictures folder on my desktop so I didn't have to, could use it without the Wi-Fi connection, but...
And actually for this, so you could use it... So for the iPad itself, it would probably need some network connectivity, but they do have an offline mode, which allows you to store it directly on the iPad itself. And generally for those storage solutions, they would allow it to, you know, if you took a picture with your iPad, it would automatically synchronize to your Mac, and it would be available offline, you know, if the internet ever got disconnected. So it's kind of storing copies on your devices, but all of the data is still stored in a central location. So even if you went to a different device, you'd still be able to log in and get your photos. But nothing that would natively use the photo app. The one solution, however, might be iCloud, which is the cloud-based service from Apple that actually might use that Photos folder and be able to synchronize between, it's really a similar service, but synchronizing between your iPhone or your iPad and your Mac desktop or laptop. So iCloud might be an option.
Okay, yeah, I've been using the iCloud, but anyway. Okay.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much for calling, Mary. Bill in Sheboygan Falls, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Jesse. Hello, Larry. Thanks for this. Older gentleman here, travel in Europe. When I last time went, my daughter was able to use her, I suppose, smartphone to look up hotels and destinations. If I go next time, hopefully, Jesse mentioned the keyboard feature as being important, and I own a Cambio by RCA. I own it right now. It fits my keyboard abilities to read email. The question, is it worth continuing to invest my time and energy in learning that as to the fact that I would be able to carry that and use it in Europe with their electrical recharging system? Okay, that's a summary of the question, I think.
All right.
And I think for the device, just like anything you're going to bring to Europe, as long as you have the right power adapters so you can convert to charge any of your devices, I think the device should work fine in Europe. I would say bring it with you. It's a nice thing to take along. Also, since the device isn't $2,000, that's always a concern when traveling with electronics. If it's really expensive, I generally say buy something cheap and take that. So that'd be actually my main concern, is bringing any device. Are you concerned if it gets damaged or lost or stolen? If you're not generally concerned with that, then I would say take it.
All right. Good luck and have a great trip. Thanks a lot for calling, Bill. Appreciate it. And Tom in Buffalo County, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Larry. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Yeah. I just got a Windows 10 laptop, and I was wanting to get Microsoft Office, so I'm out looking around, and then I find student version, home version, professional version, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
and I wanted to know what would be best for me. I really just need Excel, Word, Access, and email, and that's about it.
Yeah, and I think as far as the version of Office, I think... I think most of them, if not all of them, are going to have those four features.
Right.
I can't think of any of the other ones that just wouldn't have those. I know that some of them will come with like a OneDrive for business or Skype for business,
yeah,
or a few other applications you can actually download for free anyway.
Yeah.
But I think overall, whichever choice you pick, you're probably going to be good.
Okay. Yeah, I just need it for home here, one person, and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only thing I'd potentially look into, just depending on if you travel, use other computers, Office 365 is becoming really popular as a cloud-based solution.
Mm.
And it does, depending on what you buy, I think it's a subscription, but you'd have to take a look. It will allow you to download the actual apps and install them and still use it online. So you could actually go to a kiosk and actually use Word with your documents stored, in their cloud. So that's a potential option. But as far as which version, I think any of the versions should be okay. Obviously, if you're getting an educational version, it's a little different. They always have these nice little end user license agreements, what's legal and what's not. Those might be different between the versions. But as far as functionality, I think any of them in your case should work well.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And Gary in Oshkosh, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a laptop with Windows 10, and I've been using McAfee for my antivirus program. And I noticed now that Defender has a little button on it that says, this is Microsoft's Defender, has a little button on it that says, click here, we'll uninstall your antivirus program, and you can use our Defender. When I went to look at Microsoft's Outlook's site, they're advertising their Defender as being better and the best than anything else on the market. So I was wondering, can I stop using my antivirus, my McAfee, and just stick with the Defender? Is that as good as or better than?
And so in this case, looking at any kind of antivirus program, I think all of them have features that work better or worse than others. I don't think there's one that rules them all that actually is the 100% best in every single situation. But the Windows Defender program actually is pretty good. If it's the choice between that and paying however much money for a different software program, I'm not sure if the cost would be worth it. I think the Windows Defender application is sufficient for most people's needs. I think safe browsing and safe computer habits are another part of it. But I think it works well. It's kept updated. And, it's not something you have to really check up on. Windows, it's integrated with Windows, so there's a lot of benefits to it. But, if McAfee works too, I don't really have a preference either way. I would say use what works for you, but only use one of them at the same time. Because there can be a tendency for them to kind of fight each other if you have two antivirus programs, and it'll cause you other issues. So if you're using McAfee, use that and turn off Defender, or vice versa. But I think Defender would work well if you wanted to continue using that, but I do know that a lot of McAfee products, especially antivirus, I believe actually comes when you install or download stuff like Adobe Reader or other third-party software packages. They tend to bundle those things in if you don't uncheck the right box.
Mm, there we go. Good luck. Thank you so much. It doesn't hurt to have two on. I mean, to be able to go to two different ones, but you're saying turn one off if you're going to use the other one.
Yeah, I would, especially when they have like live active scans, you only want one running. And it can be okay to have kind of a second opinion, which is, kind of what you're doing in this case. But there are also some, at least there were, but there are actually online scanning tools where you can actually install a plugin. It'll scan your computer, and then you don't even have to really install anything. So there can be some differences, especially if you think you have an infection. I actually will scan it with multiple products because the products will see something different usually.
Thanks again, Gary, for calling. Joanne in Green Bay, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Thanks for having me on. I have two questions. First of all, I want to know, when I'm looking at my computer, like in documents, how do I know what's on the iCloud and what's on my actual hard drive? And that leads into my second question, which is I'm trying to get this computer ready to sell or junk. It's a 2009 MacBook, and I want to know what I should get off of it so that people don't get my personal information, but I don't really want to wipe the hard drive because there are some good programs that somebody else might enjoy.
Yeah.
And for, you know, what's on your iCloud and what's not, the easiest way to check is probably to log into iCloud on a web browser, just so you can see what data is out there. Otherwise, it's just very difficult to kind of double check with what's on your computer and what's on, you know, that kind of iCloud service. If you have items on your desktop and your documents folder and everything else, obviously you don't want to be giving that to somebody else when you're selling it. What I'd actually recommend doing is create a brand new user account, a generic user account that this person's going to use, you know, when they purchase it, and they can do whatever, you know, create whatever user accounts they want, and then actually delete your old user account, which should delete your user folder. It should delete all the data associated with that user account and effectively give them a clean computer with all the applications installed and, in theory, without your data. If you did store data in non-standard locations, it may be different, but that would get rid of most of it.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Talking today with Jesse LeGru from the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We'll take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Talking about computers today on the show, Larry Mueller here, my guest Jesse LeGru, technical team lead within the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Certainly you can join in. I think we have one open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas at WPR.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Jesse, earlier we had a caller who wondered about a Chromebook for her 7-year-old son. And Jerry on Facebook posted and says there's a version of the Kindle Fire, which is made for kids, durable, parental controls, and the parents can get a notice if there's a purchase made. She recommends that over a standard tablet. That sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Yeah, so it's the kids' version of the Kindle Fire. Mike in West Allis, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My question is regards to antivirus software for mobile devices like smartphones or maybe tablets as well. I know that there are products that are offered, but I really don't know a whole lot off of it. And then if there's any recommendations a guest might have as to products that could be beneficial to run on either tablets or smartphones.
Yeah, and as far as antivirus for smartphones, there are some products out there. Also some that are kind of being developed either by Cisco or Palo Alto, two big companies doing a lot of work with mobile security software. But for looking at anything specific, I don't have a specific software package that I recommend for, you know, an Android or iOS or Windows mobile device. But I'd probably, at least normally I'd stick with the main companies that do it regularly, so McAfee, Symantec. But otherwise do research just to verify that people have used and it's not not necessarily a scam. There can be, you know, generally, for example, the Apple applications are very well vetted, so there's usually less of a risk of downloading something that's going to do something bad to your computer. But even security software, I would actually be more worried about downloading onto my computer unless I really knew the company or knew that it was verified. Yeah. So I would definitely take a look at that. And as far as just general apps to have on a device outside of security software, I actually remember, I use the Google Suite. So Google Apps, Google Docs, there could be Office 365 if you have that service. But I generally also use a syncing service for files or photos. So if I'm taking a picture, I can have it backed up. Having a backup application is really nice for your phone just because we tend to use them more than just a phone. Yeah. I don't even know how much I use mine as a phone.
Right.
So the data and what you're doing on that device, having it backed up is very important so that if it breaks, you can easily replace the device and actually get all of your data back. So there's a lot of those built in for iCloud or Android Google, etc. And there's some that you can pay for out there. But I would definitely have some kind of backup application or syncing application to make sure that if your device dies, you're going to have all the stuff you need.
All right. There we go. Thanks for calling. Jonathan in Kenosha, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Love your show. I've got a question for Jesse here of Do It. How come you don't use the acronym Do It? It's a great acronym. Anyway, I'm having trouble with links, clicking on links to the internet and updating things. I probably put too much security software or scanning software to keep my computer running well. But anyway, I click on a link. And it said there's no application associated with HTTP. And so then it goes to the Google Store and tells me to pick an app. So I've been having to click on the link, open it up, copy the actual link, go to Firefox or Google Chrome, and then paste the link in. And I'm because I don't know how I change that, and there's nothing available through the Play Store. So how do I get the file association for HTTP associated with Firefox or Chrome or Explorer?
Yeah.
Okay, so are you using a Windows-based device?
Correct, Windows 10.
Okay, are you having any issues with other programs or just with web links specifically?
It's when, like, I use Advanced System Care to scan for problems, and it wants to update to the most, you know, current version. It gives me that error there as well. So I have some, like, shortcuts on the menu. I mean, shortcuts on the desktop. Like, I'll go to a site and, you know, I'll bookmark it, but I'm like, you know, I want something quick. And so I've been using that for a number of years, just dragging the icon to the desktop, and then it'll have a quick link. So I click on that, and it gives me this error. It doesn't give me an error. It just said there's no file. We don't know what to associate HTTP with. And I'm like, come on. It's, well, a link.
Yeah. Hmm.
So there's a couple ways that you can try to go about resolving it. One would be to go within, they have something called default programs in the control panel that allows you to basically pair, if I have an HTML file, for example, it will open Internet Explorer or Firefox. I would normally check there to basically set your default so that it knows what to do with it. That'd be my first.
Did that. It didn't work.
Okay.
And then I just recently, I had some problems, especially with Firefox. So I just recently reinstalled Firefox. So I got the latest version. I don't know if they're on 27 or something, Mozilla 27, whatever. I'm still having that error. So, and it went to, you know, because it asks you, when you install it, it asks you, what do you want to associate? You know, if you want HTML, HTML, you know, all those other ones.
So there, and I'm guessing, does this happen when you also click on a link within Internet Explorer or within Firefox?
No. When I'm there, I have a Dashlane password manager, and if I want to go to a different thing, I can get it. Once the browser is open, once Chrome or Firefox is open, I can go to Dashlane and say, okay, I want to check my bank account. So I'll click on that, and it'll say go to website, and I click on that, and it goes right to my bank.
Okay. One thing I'd take a look. So there is a basically Windows has something called a registry, and it stores all this information so you can open up the right program. And it if you open up a .doc file on your desktop, it opens up Word. So it knows how to do all these things. It sounds like some of that might have gotten corrupted on your computer. Normally what I would do is a couple things. There are actually some programs that might be able to resolve this themselves. I've used Super Anti-Spyware and SpyBot Search and Destroy. They're anti-malware programs, but very commonly these kind of file association problems or protocol association problems happen because of an infection. It could actually have simply been an over-aggressive security software. But I would actually recommend running both of those just to see what it has. It may or may not resolve the issue, but if it does, you're all set. Otherwise, there are, and Microsoft actually has fixes how to reset Internet Explorer file associations, which, since Internet Explorer is so tightly ingrained with Windows, if you fix it for IE, you're generally fixing it for everything.
Okay.
So that's another thing I'd recommend. Then the worst case, so anything with a registry is dangerous. If something bad happens, it's generally pretty bad. and they usually have instructions on how to do this. But if you're, you know, I Googled reset registry associations, which could be a file or protocol association, and there are sites out there that will actually give you information how to change it, or even scripts that you can run to fix it. Now, noting that, any script you download on the internet can be doing bad things.
Dun, dun, dun.
So I recommend reading around. There are things you could even do yourself, but I do think it's probably a registry corruption issue that's causing this this issue where you click on something and you get that problem.
That would make sense, because I've tried some things. I haven't tried, I mean, I have Spybot Search and Destroy, and they've got some good, in addition to looking for malware. I haven't found any malware. I've prepared whatever malware I get. But they also have those utility programs as part of Spybots or Detroit. But it would make sense that it's a registry corruption, because it keeps happening. You know,
yeah.
I clean stuff up, and then, you know, I'll try to, you know, sort through stuff. I'll scan it, clean it, restart it, and it always happens. Always comes back.
Yeah. So there you go. Good luck, Jonathan. Appreciate your call very much. And hopefully you'll get that resolved. Susan in Oshkosh, we're going to go to you next. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Larry. Thank you.
Sure.
I have a problem on my iPod, and I have an OWPR application installed.
Yeah.
And I listen frequently to, say, for instance, Larry on the radio through the iPad. Through the iPod. And if I go out of range, say I go to, you know, get the mail or something, then when I, you know, when I get back in range, the program will be stopped, and I can't unstop it. So I try to play again, and it just goes, you know, it kind of flips to stop again. It says, you know, trying, not even for a second, and then it says stopped. And I have to either restart the device or uninstall and reinstall the device, or reinstall the program in order to get it going again. And I was just wondering if there are other, say, better options, because it takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm listening to something that I think is important, and I miss it.
Yeah.
And is this specific, and did you state you had it was an iPod or an iPhone?
It's an iPod.
Okay. Actually, in this case, normally what I do, because it sounds, you know, it's uncertain whether it's your device or the app or anything else, but actually one thing I'd highly recommend is actually on the WPR site. If you go to wpr.org/apps, they actually do have a bug report email address that
okay.
You can actually tell them exactly what you're seeing and when you're seeing it, which will actually help the developers, one, troubleshoot and duplicate the issue, and then hopefully take a look at the issue and try to resolve it. Because it's uncertain in this case, you know, obviously when you're out of wireless, it makes sense that it doesn't work.
Okay.
When you're back in wireless, you know, it would make sense you'd be able to hit the button and it would work again. But if you're able to give them the information, I think it would help at least the support team, just to take a look and see if there's something that they can do on their end. Because, you know, everything you're doing to work around is exactly what I do, but I think the end goal is really to have the application behave the way you want it to. So I'd highly recommend actually submitting the information there, and they might ask you, well, what type of iPod do you have? But it's going to really help them try to resolve the issue for others that might even see the same behavior.
Yeah. As you were talking, I was wishing the team was listening in. Maybe they were. I'm not sure, but I really do hope you'll post that.
Okay, I will. And, gosh, just thanks for all the shows, Larry. And I'm so grateful you're not political.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Take care. Yeah, we don't deal with politics on this in this 90 minutes. Well, we try not to. That's for sure. Gary in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hello. I have a question about OpenVPN or VPN, where you can use your own home computer as a server when you're away. And I know some people use OpenVPN, but when I look at the Google Play Store, I see there's about a dozen of them you can choose from depending on which person developed it. And it's kind of an open software. What do you know about that, or can you help me with that, picking one, or is it a better VPN?
Yeah, and so I haven't used a whole lot of different services, but OpenVPN is one that consistently comes up of one that people I know use. So just by that alone, that's probably the one I jump on, just because I know a lot of people use it. It's up there in popularity for, you know, software being popular. What it means, usually people are developing it pretty regularly, so resolving bug fixes. That's probably the first place I'd recommend going. Granted, I haven't used a lot of those services myself, maybe stuff through work or other items, but OpenVPN's a very popular one that I'd recommend probably trying first and then seeing from there how it works for you.
I get a second question on that. Some of them say they root, you know, go to the root, and some say they don't. What's your thoughts on that?
And if it's
what does that mean, by the way, Jesse?
Yeah, and in this case, I'm imagining that you're rooting your device, which is, you know, you can do it for a variety of devices, but you can do it for Android or iOS. Basically, you're trying to get unfettered access to all of the nuts and bolts of the device so you can do something with it. Generally, it's something that the manufacturer may not want you to do because they may not want you to root your device because you are uncovering things that could break stuff. I don't root any of my devices. One, because it's just an extra headache for me to use the device, but also, you might have issues with support. So if you do root your device and it's not, you know, it's not really approved or sanctioned, if you have a problem, they say, well, you rooted it. And you know, that's probably your issue. Yes. So I would normally go with not rooting, but you can get additional benefits by rooting your device. One thing I always like to check on, and I think Google allows you to do it with like without penalty, but it's one of those end-user license agreement questions, too. Is this actually acceptable use of the device that I'm using? Am I working against the software licensing and the manufacturer by doing it? Basically, am I breaking the law? Maybe. So I'd always, you know, try to be careful with that. But I just generally go with not rooting. But as long as everything aligned properly and I get the right benefit, maybe.
All right. There we go. Good luck. Thanks, Gary. Keith in Star Lake, your turn. Hi, Keith.
Hey. My question is I switched computer security companies or coverage.
Yep.
And probably the last 6 months I've been getting a notice that my old security coverage is going to run a check on my computer. It does that, but then when it gets done, it says, we can't tell you because your contract is expired. Is that something I need to get nervous about?
That depends. I think by default, if I saw that, I'd probably be a little nervous because it does sound like they're trying to coerce me a little bit into giving them some money to deliver some information. I would uninstall the program if you're able to.
Okay.
Can you say more about what the software title is named?
Well, it's a name that Larry Mueller, or maybe it was you, says that nobody's hacked them yet, but eventually they're going to get around to it. And it's on the Honeymooners. Crandall's buddy there, Norton.
Oh. All right, there we go.
So for this one, And that this is actually common with Norton,
yeah,
or Symantec, whatever we want to call them. Since you don't have a subscription, I would recommend uninstalling it. There's no need for it to be in your computer. When you do uninstall it, it should remove those notifications, especially if you're using different software, because they will remind you, because they want to get some money for the subscription. But I would just uninstall the software, and I believe it really should get rid of those notifications. I don't think they've, went in your computer so deeply you can't get rid of it. So I just go to Programs and Features, uninstall the software, and I think at that point you should be all set. But since you're not using it, just uninstall it.
Uninstall it. There you go, Keith. Thank you for calling. Oh, boy. Greg in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Greg.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Good. Hey, I'm sure you get this a lot, but it's the first time I've listened in on the program for a while. So I have a Galaxy S7 phone, Android operating system. What do you recommend, or do you recommend any type of a virus software for an Android phone? Or is there one built in? I've kind of heard ambiguous information about it. So what do you recommend?
And for antivirus for the Android, I actually don't have anything specific that I recommend. There's a couple services that I've used. I don't actually know if they have consumer products that are available. One's from Cisco called AMP, Advanced Malware Protection. But as far as, real antivirus, there's a lot of them out there. I haven't used them a whole lot, to be honest. Have you actually went ahead and tried any?
I tried one called Clean Sweep, I believe it's called, and it turned out that it just put nothing but adware on that got more irritating than any benefit maybe I was getting.
Mm. Yeah, and the one that I see right away, I just decided to take a look at Android apps. One that I see is Kaspersky antivirus. It's free. It is on Android. It's highly rated. At least I've never used Kaspersky because I've always had other software I've been able to use. I would recommend trying it just because they generally have a pretty good support base out there, and other people do like using them. Another one that's second is AVG. I would try those. There are other, like McAfee and a few others out there, but I would actually try Kaspersky.
All right. Thanks for help.
Yeah, thanks for your calling. Appreciate it. John from Duluth called to say he has dial-up internet access only, wants to know if there's a low-cost alternative to higher speeds. He's not interested in using satellite or phone data.
Yeah, and the only thing in this case that I could recommend is sometimes there is what they call kind of metropolitan wireless. I know even around Madison they've had different services pop up where, for TDS or DSL, any company that has DSL or cable, you might have to get physical landlines. For satellite, you have to have line of sight, and there's a lot of issues. I don't know if there's anything specifically in the Duluth area, but what I would look at is any kind of wireless services that you could take advantage of. And it's usually kind of a metropolitan wireless subscription. It could be anywhere from $10 to $20 a month, but it always depends on the service. So it's one thing I take a look at.
And with that, we're out of time. Jesse, thanks so much. You're back July 3rd.
Yes.
All right. Look forward to your next visit. Jesse LeGrue, technical team lead with the UW-Madison's Do It! Division of Information Technology. Great to have him along. He's back July 3rd. Tomorrow we'll take a look at holistic veterinarian Carrie Donahue. Stay with us.